Welcome to Strong Black Legends, the show where we give flowers to the legends of Black film and television, brought to you by Netflix and Strong Black Lead. Each week, we talk with the folks that have paved the way for us to imagine what was possible, both on and off screen. I am your host, Tracy Clayton, aka Queen of the Crochet Click. Yes, Black women crochet. Crochet is better than knitting. Those knitters ain't got nothing on us. I'm calling y'all out. Step up. Just like all the other episodes of Strong Black Legends, I have to begin by practicing to be the kind of parent that I want to be. And that's the kind that busts in on you and your friends while you're hanging out and is like, hey, you don't know nothing about this song that I'm playing in here that you can't even hear for some reason. I don't know. It's just my destiny. That's who I'm supposed to be. So, I know you know about Omar Epps, but what y'all know about Omar Epps? Honestly, where do I even begin with Omar Epps? I mean, he's Omar Epps. He's Omar Epps. He played a dude named Q twice in two different movies. It does not get any more iconic or legendary or black than that. This is the man that got a career-defining role straight out of high school. You know how long it took me to find a job after I got out of high school? Years. He was just an itty-bitty little old baby taking Hollywood by storm. There's the film Juice, which co-starred an up-and-coming legend at that time, Tupac Shakur, RIP, you know, no big deal. And we also know Omar as the basketball player that almost played us all, Double or Nothing, in Love and Basketball. But these two iconic films don't even begin to scratch the surface of all of the dope roles that we have seen Omar in throughout his career. And in case you didn't know, he's not related to Mike Epps. Anyway, I got a chance to talk to the man himself, and he's definitely got the juice, the sauce, and all the good stuff in the fridge. I'm hungry. I'm gonna get something to eat. Y'all take a listen for yourself. Today's icon, I am happy to say, is the one and only Mr. Omar Epps. Hello.
How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So, this is basically going to be a love fest and a celebration of all the amazing contributions that you have made to Black people in film, television, et cetera, et cetera. But first, I want to talk about Omar before Omar knew that he wanted to be an actor. Mm. So, I hear a little birdie told me that you grew up in East New York in East Flatbush. Mm-hmm. And I happen to live in Flatbush right now. It is my favorite part of Brooklyn.
I grew up in the old Flatbush.
Right, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because right now Flatbush is, it's just about starting to get a little gentrified, I think. Mm-hmm. Tell me what it was like when you were there.
It was great growing up in New York in those times, and you know, it was just a different time. It was dangerous, it was exciting, you know. But that sense of, you know, that New York community was really strong in all the different cultures and the different foods and mm-hmm. Different ethnicities, different belief systems, all of that stuff, I think, poured into me, you know, as a kid growing up in New York. And I think it helped me in my artistry moving forward.
In your artistry.
Yeah.
How do you think your artistry would have been different if you were from anywhere else?
I can't answer that question because there are great artists from all over the world. Yeah. I just know my experience, you know, it help open my mind, you know, to see different ways of life and the whys and the histories of different cultures at such a young age helped me open my mind. And I think in being an actor and being in these different characters and these different journeys, it's allowed me to sort of stretch my muscle, if you will, in a different way.
Where were you introduced to the arts? Like, when did you know that, like, okay, this is a thing that I might want to do?
For me, it was always in my family. My grandfather, rest his soul, he was a jazz musician. My grandmother was just a Renaissance woman. She was a singer, she was an educator, she was a photographer, she's written books.
Wow.
You know, so like when I was a kid, she had a dark room. I'll show you how far back that was, but she used to really, you know, develop her pictures, and she was just always had an artistic mind. And so for me, I was into literature pretty early. I was into like poetry and things of that nature, you know, dabbling around with music. And and then I did a school play, and that's when I got bit by that proverbial bug they talk about.
Yeah, what was the play?
It was Grease.
Grease, oh my gosh, who were you in Grease?
I played Duty.
Who?
duty was like one of the dudes over there.
Oh, but, okay, that's appropriately named.
But you know, I got to be on stage and experience that feeling and that connection with the audience. And then for me also as well, when I was growing up, Sidney Poitier was my acting hero, and just his power, his elegance, his grace that permeated off screen really spoke to my spirit. So, you know, once I did that school play, I was like, I think I want to try this.
Yeah, did you feel like you were good at it?
I felt that I was better than Errol Graves, who in my junior high school was written to be the successful actor in our yearbook. Sorry, Errol. I still remember this guy. Like, that was etched into my memory. I'm like, I'm going to be a better actor than Errol Graves.
We all need that fuel to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
So I also know that you went to LaGuardia High School, which, if I understand correctly, is like the high school from fame. And while you were there, you went to school with Marlon Wayans of the Wayans clan of approximately 8,000 children.
Right. And counting.
And counting. And counting, indeed. So while you were in high school, were you also like out auditioning and getting gigs and like working in addition to being a kid and going to school?
Yeah, Marlon and I used to audition for commercials, and he would always beat me out. But it was cool, because that's my boy. But, you know, we were doing stuff like that, like nothing major. But you got to remember, I'm in school with, like, Dondre Whitfield, you know? I'm in school with Carl Payne, like, these guys on The Cosby Show.
Yeah. They're,
like, pass them in the hallway, like, whoa.
Wow.
You know, this thing is real.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of, you know, but I enjoyed my school time. I'm glad I didn't work that early.
Yeah.
Because I really feel specifically for actors that you need a life to pull from. To pour back into your characters, you know. And even though I got started early, I mean, I did Juice when I was 17, but my 17 back then was like the average 25-year-olds now. So,
yeah.
I'd seen and been through so much.
Well, speaking of Juice, thank you for offering
me that
amazing
segue.
I did. It looked planned, didn't it, y'all? Nope, that was just natural chemistry right there. This was your first film ever. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
When I first heard that, I was like, no way. There's no way that this was his first film, because it was just, the acting in that film was phenomenal. And I think it showed me a world that I was like, I don't know if, like, does this happen in the world? Like, are there Black people like this? And by like this, I basically mean like different from me. I grew up in Kentucky, which, you know, had its rough parts and everything, but just like the depth that we saw of the characters. And of course, Pac's performance. I would imagine that you get asked a lot about this idea that playing Bishop, which was Pac's role, changed him, like, by the end of the movie. Is that something that you hear a lot?
No.
No?
No, that wasn't it. Pac was already on his way. I mean, he was writing his first album while we were filming the movie. He had already sort of been semi-famous because, you know, his whole experience with Digital Underground. And so he was sort of breaking into his own, and it was both of our first films. But Pac was an actor, like a trained actor. And that's why those performances were so great. And I think that also the timing of when Juice was happening, it was just magical, because you also have to look at, like, the cult, we call it the culture now, but it's hip hop. It was all happening at the same time. So it was all exploding at the same time. And we were sort of that second wave after Spike Lee of the young culture. So for us, we were these four kids. We could so relate to it because it was us.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't necessarily know each other personally, but it was easy to put, okay, he's that archetype, he's that archetype, he's that, you know. And Pac and I had a somewhat similar dynamic to Bishop and Q.
You know,
I was sort of the, you know, responsible one, and he was sort of the renegade. But he was a great brother. Great brother, yeah.
Do you remember where you were when you heard the news that you got the role?
Yeah, I was at home.
Yeah.
I was at home, and the phone rang. It's before we had cell phones, y'all. the phone rang, and it was Ernest Dickerson. And he said, hey, man, you got the role. And I was like, wow, that's, you know, that was incredible. And I called my mom. She was like, all right, cool. But it was like,
y'all were so chill about it.
Well, because it was we didn't know exactly what was happening.
Yeah.
You know, because even though it was my first film, like, I was taking the train to set. You know, I lived at the time in East New York, and we were filming all the way in Harlem, so I ended up going to stay with the first AD.
That's a stretch.
Because he lived downtown Brooklyn, so it was easier to, you know, it was still brass tacks. It wasn't like limos were coming to pick me up and we were helicoptering, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it was still, you know, it was still grounded. The experience of it was still grounded.
Right.
But it was incredible. It was incredible. It was also dangerous. Again, we filming like in the middle of the hood in Harlem.
Yeah, and I'm sure Harlem was a different place back then too.
Harlem was a very different place back
then.
That's when they, you know, I mean, Pac was befriending certain cats on the set, and the next thing you know, while we at lunch, they running up in his trailer.
Oh Lord.
Steal jewelry and stuff. So.
Oh my gosh.
This is the old New York. This is the real New
York. Right.
Yeah.
I was going to ask for a favorite behind-the-scenes story. Maybe what is your most memorable behind-the-scenes story?
One of my most memorable behind-the-scenes stories of Juice is one morning we came in and you know, we were reading the papers and some woman had thrown her baby in the trash, right?
Oh.
Horrible. But it's also horrible that was normal to me growing up in New York. Mm. You heard stories like that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tupac was really, really affected that day, and he just kept talking about it. And then by lunchtime, he was like, yo, come in the trailer. And he starts rapping, you know, his song. And I'm like, man, yeah, that's cool. And then so we wrapped the film, and a few months later, his first album comes out, and I hear Brenda's Got a Baby.
I knew you were gonna say Brenda's
and
Got a Baby.
And I was blown away.
Wow.
That right there, I knew, he's special.
Yeah.
He's gonna go somewhere completely different.
Wow. I love that story so much.
Yeah.
I love it so much. So shortly after that, you are in Daybreak and The Program, both in 1993. Hardworking man, same year, I can't imagine. So Daybreak was like a dystopian sci-fi type movie. Very, very different from Juice, genre-wise.
It was based on a play.
Based on a play?
Yep.
Oh, that part I don't think I knew.
Mm-hmm.
How did your preparation for this sci-fi role differ from your preparation for the role in Juice?
I guess it differed in terms of like trying to understand the world of Daybreak. Because as you mentioned, it was just sort of, I don't know if it was so much sci-fi as it's like pushing the boundaries of, you know, it's kind of like this apocalyptic world.
I think that's the word that I meant. Yeah.
So it was just kind of trying to imagine yourself in that circumstances. What was fun for me with Daybreak is that the role they originally wanted me for, to come and read for, is not the role that I responded to.
Hmm.
And so I had told my team about the role that I responded to, and they were like, well, that's written for a white dude.
Ah.
And I was like, so? And they were like, but that's not what... Like, it's written for, like, a 25-year-old white dude, an 18-year-old black kid.
Right.
And so what I did when I went into the audition was I just signed up for that role and then got it.
Wow. You were like, ha-ha.
Nah, not so much that, but it was just, you know, when you're young and I think your naivete can shield you from certain realities. You know, but that was fun for me. That was a fun experience, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How often did situations like that pop up in your career where, like, there's a role that you want, but, like, race is a thing that could have barred you from it or should have barred you from it?
It's happened a few times.
Yeah.
It's happened a few times. I think that's what's exciting about now is that that's changing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think that a lot of not only filmmakers, but, like, studios are challenging themselves to say, hey, why can't this, they call it diverse, but, you know, why can't this role be a female or be black or be Asian or be Latino, like, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think they're trying to at least push the boundaries so that what we see on film or television can look like what the world really looks like.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That was very, very well said. I place you in like this group of black actors who obviously very talented, versatile, can play just about any character in any genre, but my favorite is like the movies about black men being friends and just like black friendship.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings me to The Wood in 1999, which is one of those movies that I watched. My mother may or may not used to bootleg movies because she had two VCRs. Not saying that she did, not saying that she didn't, but that was one of the movies that I would just like watch over and over and over. And in this movie, you're acting with Taye Diggs and Richard T. Jones and just like, just actors that I feel like I know because I've seen you all in so many things growing up. Was the chemistry that you all had on that set like natural, organic? Were y'all all friends off set? Did y'all just like go to clubs together and stuff? Like,
no, I've met those guys during that, you know, that experience. And it, I think, again, it kind of, because we were kind of all around the same age and the gel kind of came naturally. Mm-hmm. Because at that point, you know, we'd done a little bit of work, had our sea feet underneath us, and it was just like, let's just go have some fun. And I think we could all relate again to not only those characters, but that camaraderie.
Yeah.
You know, like for me, it was like, it's Marlon and my other boy, Mitchell Marchand, who's a writer. Mm-hmm. We were the three musketeers.
Yeah.
So it was easy for me to sort of find my character in that. And I'd assume the same for Taye and Richard.
Yeah. It seems like a situation like that would lend itself to a lot of improvised moments. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but it just seems like, you know, like y'all got the chemistry down, everything like makes sense and you're comfortable. Were there a lot of like improvised moments in that movie?
I wouldn't say there were a lot, but there were definitely some.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that makes for fun. And you know, Rick Famuyiwa was super talented and he was collaborative and he had such a clear vision and he just anchored that so well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I would get run out of town on a rail if I did not mention Love and Basketball, especially by most of the people sitting behind me. They were like, make sure you go on Love and Basketball. Yeah, yeah. Those are my bullies. Hi. So I've noticed that on Twitter and social media especially, there's been a lot of renewed conversation about Love and Basketball. You play a guy named Q, and basketball, your moves, you know, the crossover was like,
It was that was tough training.
I was gonna ask about that. Did you have to like train with the coach?
Yeah. We trained like really hard, and Sanaa trained really hard as well.
Mm-hmm.
And just basketball is just a different, I'm more of a contact football, boxing guy, just the stop and go of
like
basketball
pain
was,
and just like,
was a little tough.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think we pulled it off in the movie.
Yeah. I mean, it was very believable. I was like, that looks like actual basketball. So you did good. What kind of response did Love and Basketball get, like, once it debuted?
It got a good response. I just told somebody the other day, it's like Love and Basketball is one of those bittersweet things because it seems to have gotten a bigger response umpteen years later.
Yeah.
Than it actually did in the box office.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it came out, it did okay, it did fairly well, but you know, the word of mouth and people liked it. I don't remember what else was out at the time, but it's just like, it's like a generations later, like people go crazy over this film, so.
What do you make of that? Like, why do you think that is?
I think it's great storytelling. I think it's great storytelling. You know, Gina Blackwood wrote a great movie with timeless stories. I think when you look at not only the dynamic between Monica and Q, but like her dynamic with her mom, and then you got the family dynamic with Q's mom and dad, and then you got the father-son dynamic. There was just so many elements of life that I think you got to explore that are timeless. And then obviously that sort of fairy tale love story of two people who grew up together, know each other from childhood, you know, go their ways.
Girl next door.
Yeah, and then come back around. And that's sort of a fairy tale love story, so, you know.
Are sex scenes weird?
They are.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are weird. Because it's like a bunch of people standing around.
While you
and we're over here
somebody.
Like, you know?
Yeah.
But they can be weird or uncomfortable. For me, it's always paramount that, you know, the woman feels comfortable and that the set is a safe environment. And, you know, once you take care of all of that stuff, then let's just, you know, create the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your children,
mm-hmm.
have they seen Love and Basketball?
I think so, yeah. I don't know if my son has, but I think my oldest and my youngest daughter have. Yeah.
Did they tell you what they thought of it? Did they like it? Were they like, ew?
Well, apparently, like, the kids in my youngest daughter's school, like, they're all watching it now, so they call her Q.
Aww.
And she's just like, it's weird, Dad. Like,
that is so funny.
Yeah.
Do any of your kids want to go into acting one day?
I'm not sure.
If they did, would you be supportive or would you be like, eh?
I would be supportive as long as they took it seriously, take the craft seriously and you know, don't think it's gonna be easier because I'm their dad.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the other part of me that, the protective part of me is, you know, knowing how hard this industry is, you know, I might, you know, be hesitant, but I'd want to support them. I want to support them in whatever they want to do, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What advice would you give them? You can give them one piece of advice.
It's a business. It's a business.
Mm-hmm. That is so simple, but so true. All of the movies, you've just been acting your little behind off. And you're like, you know what? Let's do some TV.
Mm-hmm.
And you were on The House for the entire 8 seasons, I do believe.
Yep.
I'm trying to find a delicate way to say, I love the show.
Thank you.
But I hated House, like his character.
Mm-hmm.
He just.
Which is why you love the show.
I think so.
Yeah.
You just answered the question for me, I think.
That character was like an anti-hero hero.
And anti-hero hero. Say a little more.
Because, you know, House was just so brash and just coarse and.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that audiences connected to was he just gave it to you straight.
Mm.
He always told the truth. And I think that, you know, through all of his antics, people got to appreciate that from the character. But I think that's part of the secret sauce of, it was like a love-hate thing.
It sure was. Because I was just like, he reminds me of every white man that I've ever disliked.
Damn.
I know. I was just like,
That's not generalizing.
What does that word mean? I would never. So you were on the show for its entire 8-year run.
Mm-hmm.
What was it about that show that made you want to stick with it that long?
It was just an incredible experience. You know, at that point in my career, I felt like I needed to throw a curveball. I needed to do something that, you know, people wouldn't see coming.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got that opportunity. And right away, you know, the scripts that were coming in were just so genius to me and so challenging to me as an actor. It was a new form. Doing television, and it was a grind. I mean, it was super intense, but once we got through that first season and we all kind of felt like, you know, we had something, you know, it was just a blast. It was so much fun.
Yeah.
Great memories, yeah.
What's the biggest difference in filming a movie versus filming TV?
Really, the biggest difference is really simple. It's just the speed.
Oh.
That's really all, you know, because when you're doing a television show or 1-hour drama, you're basically doing a film, but in 8 days. It's like a mini movie.
Hmm.
Or 7 days, you know, which is really not a lot of time.
Yeah, it doesn't
so,
sound like
you know, the hours are long, it's a grind. Whereas with the film, you know, if you have either 4 weeks or 8 weeks, or you just have time to do 2 scenes in a day.
Yeah.
You know, and take your time with it, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, a little birdie told me that you are returning to movies in a little number called Fatal Affair, due out this year, where you star with Nia Long.
Yep.
What can you tell me about the movie?
It's a really fun film. You know, and I have a blast working with Nia.
Mm-hmm.
We got to do the dance again. And basically, it's a dark thriller.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I love a dark thriller.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming you can't tell me which of you murders the other one.
Probably. No, I couldn't tell you that.
Okay. But maybe somebody murders the other one.
I mean, you know, we
gotta
know
watch
what's gonna
it,
happen.
I guess.
You gotta buckle up.
I see how that works. I'm excited. I just love black people in like thrillers and suspenseful movies and like crime and serial killers and stuff, which is probably saying more about like my personality, but I just really love it when like we're quote unquote allowed to play those roles,
right.
You know?
That's a powerful word that you just said, allow.
Hmm.
And you know, we also have to be a bit forceful in taking through our storytelling, through our producing. And that's what excites me about the younger generation of filmmakers is that they're stretching the boundaries of you know, what black and brown can be and say on film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can do, I mean, the biggest example in the last few years is Black Panther.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
It's just like, what do you mean? We can't make multi-billion dollar international franchises.
Right.
So, you know, whether it's, you know, sci-fi, whether it's horror, whether it's, you know, to your point, thrillers. Mm-hmm. We can do it all because yeah. we're in this world doing it all.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So of this new class of filmmakers that you referenced, who are you excited about?
Ryan Coogler is definitely, I'm really proud of that brother. Mm-hmm. Excited about Barry Jenkins. Ava's not necessarily new, but she's mm-hmm. killing it. You know, yeah. all of them. All of them that are doing their things. I salute them and, you know, hopefully we'll have the opportunity to work with some of them mm-hmm. in the near future. So let's just put that in there.
Yeah, I mean, manifest it. It has to happen now.
Yeah.
It's in the atmosphere. Okay, so I think we got you for about 10 more minutes, which is perfect because that's about how much time we'll need for our rapid fire segment.
Okay.
Rapid fire. Favorite Tupac song?
I Am Mad At You.
The most fun you've ever had on the set?
Most fun I've ever had on the set is probably the set of Shooter, when I was doing the show called Shooter with mm-hmm. Ryan Phillippe. And, we were just like kids in a candy store. We got to fight and shoot guns every day, so that was
what
fun.
What every man wants.
I mean, generalizing.
You got me again. Take a shot every time I generalize. Who was your first celebrity crush?
First celebrity crush was Tamara Dobson, who played Cleopatra Jones.
Oh, Cleopatra Jones.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Okay, this is one of my favorite questions. You are at a black function. Mm-hmm. Funeral, wedding, baby, doesn't matter. Electric slide happens. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, not the electric slide. Soul Train line.
Okay.
I'm sure somebody may have done a Soul Train line during a funeral. I don't know.
It's a little weird, but keep going.
You know.
I'm in with you.
Okay, that's the important part. So it's your turn, top of the Soul Train line. What move are you doing to take you down the line?
I probably bust out the rerun.
The rerun with all the pop locking and
pop locking.
When he did that?
Yeah.
That was my attempt at pop locking.
I probably bust that out.
Okay.
Just to make people laugh.
Tell me one underappreciated black artist that you would give flowers to, if you could.
An underappreciated black artist that I would give flowers to? Oh man,
it's a doozy.
Yeah, that's a, I would say Wood Harris.
Uh-huh.
I think he's underappreciated as an actor. You know, personally, I think he's phenomenal, brilliant. I think he deserves his roses. So Wood, love you, brother, salute.
All right, these roses are for you, Wood, these theoretical roses. Last question. If it were possible to pull your black card, you know what I mean by that? Like, oh, you don't like this thing, your black card's been pulled.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to give an example.
Oh, God. I think I know what you're going to say.
Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. So.
I've been trying to think of another answer. Go ahead.
Okay. So I will throw myself in the trenches with you, and I will admit that I do not own a single jar or bottle or container.
Of hot sauce? Oh my, yeah, your black card is yanked for like a year.
I'm telling people that.
Oh my goodness.
See, I'm trying to like.
And you're from Kentucky? Goodness gracious, it just compounds.
Yeah.
Why is that?
It hurts.
What do you mean it hurts?
Spicy food hurts. It's not, to me, it's not a flavor. It's just
yeah,
like
but
a,
as a
ouch.
Black person, it is your obligation to have a bottle of hot sauce somewhere in your fridge or your cupboard. Because if I come over for dinner.
You're going to have to bring your own hot sauce.
That's terrible.
Because if I invite you to my home, we're clearly friends. You know. It's
I don't know if we could be friends now.
That's fair. Okay, this is not about me, okay? I am the interviewer. I'm the one with the power. What are we pulling your black card for?
Pulling my black card for? I think I got a lifetime membership.
Why you play me like that?
See, I'm just saying.
I was going to make it easier for you.
Nah, well, I got an assortment of hot sauces.
Well, okay, that's not the only thing that makes a black person black.
What? Because I eat oysters?
What?
Black people eat oysters.
Ah.
What?
So,
mm-hmm.
I have an amazing team of producers mm-hmm. behind me.
Uh-huh.
And some research was done, and it appears that a certain someone does not play spades?
Yeah.
Hold on.
Let me clarify this.
Okay, go ahead.
I know how to play spades, I just don't play spades.
Okay.
I don't play dominoes.
But you know how to play.
But I shoot dice.
I just feel like there was a moment when I bared my soul. You over here not playing spades and didn't even meet me halfway on that.
Listen, I'm traumatized from spades. I've saw too many fights.
You know what?
I've jumped in between too many fights happening over a card game, so.
Mm-hmm. And see, I understand.
You know?
I would have been like, see, same thing.
But you can't pull my black card for not being able to.
I can, so.
Not playing spades and not having hot sauce is two totally different universes.
We're not comparing the two, I'm just saying.
That's the takeaway. The takeaway that we got is that you don't have any hot sauce in your crib.
That's the takeaway.
But you doing strong black.
You know what? You can check your black card on your way out. But this has been so much fun.
This has been awesome.
Thank you for hanging out with me.
Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah.
Okay, y'all, do me a favor real quick. Unless you're driving, in which case, do not do this. Ready? Close your eyes. You are at the cookout, right? Your mama's there, so is her potato salad. There's baked macaroni and cheese. There's cousins that you just met that particular day playing spades. Everybody is in the same t-shirt. You look over to the left, and you see your cool auntie in her head-to-toe matching fit. Maybe it's plaid. Maybe it's paisley. She's wearing sunglasses and boots. Doesn't matter if the sun's out. Doesn't matter what the weather is. She's drinking a wine cooler, and she's asking for the aux cord. She connects it to her Android phone, and boom! You might have guessed it. This week, my flowers go to, drumroll please, Cookout Music! Yay! Cookout Music! So, what do I mean by Cookout Music? I'm talking about the music that makes all the uncles and aunties go, oh, shit, nah. And then sometimes they go, that's my jam. And then, of course, they go, what y'all know about this? These are the songs that make everybody of all ages put down their sweet tea and their lemonade and assume the position for the electric slide or a Soul Train line, depending on how drunk everyone is. It's also probably the music that your mama played on Saturday mornings while she cleaned the house with all the doors open. You remember that? I remember that. Cookout Music is the soundtrack of Black family joy, and I listen to it whenever I get homesick. That and Kirk Franklin. That also works too. I challenged myself to put together the ultimate cookout playlist, but as they say, it takes a village, so yours truly took to these Brooklyn streets. You're welcome. I went outside for y'all and asked, what would go on your cookout playlist?
The Temptations, that's number one.
Mary J. Blige. Family Affair.
I'm still rolling with Biggie, man. Okay. I'm still rolling with Biggie. You heard Juice? Uh-huh. Juicy? Juicy ain't never going out of style.
That's a fact.
You can play that anywhere.
I want to hear some old school 90s music, okay? I want to go back from all the way to R&B, and I want to move up to the rap and the hip hop.
Okay.
I want to hear 90s.
Pop Smoke, you know, Welcome to the Party, Dior. Stuff like that, you know, a lot of the down south music.
If Poison is playing when you walk into the cookout,
you know it's gonna be a good cookout.
The ribs are gonna
be fire. The ribs are gonna be done just right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the meat seasoned just well.
Yeah.
And somebody for something to punch.
All right.
So
I'm trying to go to that cookout.
Frankie Beverly and Maze, you know how I go.
You make me happy.
Come on now. Hey.
Before I let go.
Hey, we know that
part. You, man. That's it. You gotta bring it back. You gotta bring it back. You gotta bring it back.
So as I walked through the streets of Brooklyn, which you're welcome, I did that for you, I was really taken aback by the answers that I got and the choices for cookout music. I expected to hear a lot of Cameo and a lot of Parliament and Chaka Khan, but I think that our cookout playlist is evolving with the times. Can you believe that? And you know what? That makes me very happy, because the reason that people like Cameo and Parliament and Chaka Khan are fixtures on the playlist is because they're tied to memories and nostalgia, like Meemaw's potato salad or Ain't Lorraine killing it on the dance floor, or that one time that you beat Pop Pop and Bidwist, which has never happened before. So congratulations. So cookout music, old and new, these flowers are for you. Y'all, we made it to the end of another episode. I had fun. Did y'all have fun? Because I had fun. I hope everybody had fun, and we should keep doing this. Next week? Same time? Yeah. All right. This show is a production of Pineapple Street Studios in partnership with Netflix and Strong Black Lead. Executive producers are Max Linsky, Jenna Weiss-Berman, Jasmine Lawson, and Agarinesh Ashagre. Our lead producer is Josh Gwynn. Production by Jess Jupiter and Janelle Anderson, with additional production support by Cindy Okereke and Alexis Moore. Our music is by the incredible Don Will. You can follow him on all the socials at DJ Don Will. And guess what? If you give him some money, he will make you a thing. It's true. I have been your host, Tracy Clayton, and you can find me on Instagram at Broken McPoverty. Come say hey. I get lonely very easily. So please hurry up, come quickly. Make sure to follow us on the socials at Strong Black Lead. And if you enjoyed what you heard, if you had fun hanging out with me today, tell a friend. And also, please don't forget to rate and subscribe to Strong Black Legends on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever free podcasts are sold. Until next time, friends and family, keep shining bright like the truth that Zaya Wade was spitting to D-Wade in that video of them in the golf cart. God bless the children. Love y'all. Bye.